Session number 11736, Stephen Pete, Reel 3.
This is Stephen Pete, Reel 3.
And your film, what sort of, what was the purpose of it? You know, were you hoping to show it to a wider public, or was it just a record for the FAU?
I think I looked upon it as a record for the FAU. I looked upon it as a personal chance to get behind the camera and make a film which was I was hungry for. So it's a mixture of personal wish and an accepted offer. Yes, a record for the FAU for showing internally. Is that the right word? You know, to FAU people about what they were doing and. Anybody who wanted to borrow it and fundraising, maybe. But the main thing, as far as I was concerned, was making it and editing it and having it there. And then not long after I'd finished it, I went abroad anyway, so that was that. But I was just telling you about this air raid in May 41 in the City of London, and we... Oh, that's right. Firstly, we had to evacuate all the people in the shelter because police or wardens, I forget which, came and said it's the whole building's burning above, and we had to evacuate to another building, all the people down the street, and then a third time during the night. And at one of those buildings, I don't remember which, the air raid warden came down and said, come with me, it's fantastic. And we went up, very stupidly, to the roof of the building, and just for a few minutes, and saw what looks like some of these famous wartime photographs. We went far from St. Paul's, and all around were fires burning, all around the whole city, and St. Paul's in the middle and in the smoke, and planes still flying over too. It was a pretty crazy thing to do, but it was an unforgettable scene. And the next morning, I mean, we, as I said, evacuated to a third place, and then the raid finished and everybody went off safe. Walking back from there, because it had to be walking to the students' hostel, through the City of London first and then out into the East End, with all the broken glass and the burning buildings, it was unbelievable and awful.
What sort of state were the shelters in, you know, with these three evacuations?
Well, I suppose, well, everybody, there can't have been people lying around sleeping. I'm now imagining, because I remember the doorway, going out through the doorway with a policeman there, and just before going, an enormous explosion outside, and him standing immobile and then saying to me, don't worry, Sonny, because I'd probably dive to the floor. I suppose there were just people there waiting and hoping for the morning, and then glad to get up and go and see if their homes were still there.
Is there much panic, though, in that situation?
I don't remember, and I'm sure I would have remembered panic, yeah. And this, after all, wasn't the first raid. This was a larger and more extensive and more dangerous raid for that particular area. I don't remember how deep a shelter it was. A lot of the buildings in the city had one, two, three, you know, triple basements down. There was one where I was on duty several times in Lloyd's, the huge, where the bell is rung at ships being lost, and that was three stories down below the ground floor. That was an amazing place. I never remember feeling advanced claustrophobia of what would have happened if the place had collapsed on top or the doors had got bombed. I don't remember that at all. Probably had it at the time. And when we were on duty, we were busy.
Yes, I was going to ask you, what were you actually doing in the
Well, we had first first aid places, and people with all sorts of minor ailments and minor injuries too would come there. So they were first aid and general keeping the morale up. So we helped organise concerts and all sorts of things going on.
Were you the only group, the FAU, doing that in the shelters you worked in? Or no, were there other groups working with you?
I'm sure there were many other groups, including groups who... So that the shelters in which the FAU worked in were scattered around. I'm sure there were lots of other groups, you know, the Salvation Army and these kind of people going around giving help or being responsible for certain shelters. Must have been lots of groups.
Yeah. One hears an awful lot, you know, and particularly at this time, you know, with the 50th anniversary of the war, which is going on, isn't it, for another 5-6 years, about the spirit of Londoners, you know, in the Blitz. What did you find? You know, was there such a thing as this sort of spirit the Londoners were supposed to have had demonstrated?
Seemed to be. And also, it... It the business of bringing people together, and neighbourhoods were brought together by a common difficulties. What I do remember is just as the first raid started, a conversation of two old women somewhere in Shadwell or Stepney, and when posters had gone up saying bomb Berlin, it hadn't happened, and there was, I don't know who was putting posters up saying this, but there were, or maybe it was graffiti or whatever, being most moved by these old women. And they were bombed out people, or places which had been largely bombed out, in the shelter one night, saying, you know, I don't hold with this bombing of Berlin business. It's bad enough being bombed here, but think of it happening to other people. It's awful. This was quite extraordinary to me. Anyhow, where were we? Oh, yeah, evacuation, an evacuation centre. This was another one-off thing that the FAU did. A huge house in High Barnet, in a suburban street of huge houses, was presumably the family that lived there had gone away and it was commandeered or whatever. And as an experiment, it was made a centre for bombed-out families from East or West Ham. And the FAU ran that with a group of 4 or 5 of us. I also filmed it for this little film when I was no longer working there. And that was an extraordinary business. There were 85 people in this one house, mainly in families, or two families in the big rooms, and everybody ate communally. Presumably the food coupons were pooled, and that must have been. So that was an experiment. Again, I don't know how it ended. It was to a less bombed part of London, rather than getting people way and out, and I suppose the breadwinners of the family were able to travel from there to wherever they worked. So my memory of that side of it is very vague indeed, because running it was a full-time job. And
When you say running it, sort of organising the families?
Organising the day-to-day running of it, because a group that size needed organising. Who lived in what room, what time meals were, and who could come for the first sitting and the second sitting and the third sitting, and who would look after the many chickens in the garden and all the rest of it, and run the accounts. Yeah, it must have been a pooled amount of money and a pooled coupon system. Having described all this, my actual memory of it is really rather vague. Or what happened to it, or whether it was a success as an experiment. I don't think it could have been, otherwise there must have been, it would have been more large houses like that commandeered in London. I think that was the thing. There were plenty of large houses out in the country commandeered for evacuees or for bombed out people. That's a rather unsatisfactory story.
This, of course, is... You were saying this is 1941, isn't it? We're coming up to 1942.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, yes.
You did mention earlier on, when you were describing your film, I think, how people were then getting ready to go to China. Mm-hmm. You yourself, were you wanting to go abroad for overseas service? What was the... Did you sort of place your name on a list or volunteer for this? I was wondering what the system was for overseas service. Why some went and others didn't in the FAU?
I think you'd have to ask some administrator who would remember that. My memory is of volunteering to go. Probably you were given the chance of saying you had strong reasons for not wanting to go, for family reasons, or strong reasons for wanting to go, and therefore be on a list.
China, for instance.
China was, as far as I remember, various people volunteered and gave good reasons why they particularly wanted to go.
Were you tempted with China?
No, I don't remember being, no.
No, I understand people had to show a concern for China. That's the way it was put to me once.
So whether I quote you, showed a concern for going to the Middle East or not, I really can't recall. All I know is I was on a list. And for a long time, because there were some people out there already in Egypt and in North Africa, I mean, when I say some people, some of the FAU, and including a group who had been in Finland and then managed to get into Sweden and then were taken to, or managed to get to Egypt after that, and they were working out there. Then that lot, most of them, went to Greece and were captured, were in prison camps. I'm not sure the dates of all this, the invasion of Greece. But anyway, it was many months, and this, during those many months, waiting to go to North Africa, or to the Middle East, I suppose it was called. What I was personally doing, I guess I was working in a mixture of air raid shelters and on hospital duty. Oh, and also, way back, around about this time, driving training. I really don't know when I had that. Probably earlier on in London. I learned on a little two-seater, Morris Minor, or the equivalent of that, at first, and then graduated to some of the larger vans, and in fact at one period was one of the people, I think there were two or three of us, running the vans, or driving the various vans around the various FAU contingents in London, taking the supplies and the food supplies and people and all the rest of it from headquarters at student hostel to the various groups. There was one in Kentish Town near here, transport group, and there was a women's section of the FAU in Canonbury. They had a house to themselves there. They were segregated for a while, I realise, although my memory was quite a lot of them were in the students' hostel at one time. I don't know whether some were there and some were in Canonbury. I'm not sure.
Can you remember any reaction when women suddenly came to the unit? You know, did it impress you at all that women were suddenly allowed in? Did it make any difference?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, definitely made a difference. And one of them was a cousin of mine, Elizabeth Hughes, who she was led to join the unit, I think, partly because she worked as a nurse in Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. So she and various other nurses, we got to know well, I knew her already as a cousin, but a lot of us got to know while we were at training camp. And she, I think, I'm not sure, must have been one of the first women members, I'm not really sure. But very useful, you know, already as a trained nurse. Oh, it was very nice having women around, but there were too few of them, shall we put it this way, I think.
Were there any problems caused, Julia, when women, for instance, in the hostel, when they started appearing in the London hostel? Can you remember any?
I don't remember any problems, no. There were two or three couples formed and marriages all through the war. In fact, on the ambulance train, this is what, not with an FAU woman, but one of the Red Cross nurses, married Marcus Rumpus's brother, Herbert Rumpus. There's another mention of the Rumpus family, who was a nurse on that train. And the same happened to quite a lot of people, not unnaturally at all.
Would you say they enriched the unit in any way?
Oh, yes.
The women, what did they bring to it, do you think?
Oh, dearie me. Women's touch. The companionship. Yes, indeed. They must have felt a bit of a difficulty, I think, being in such a small minority all the time, because it didn't by anything. I don't know what the percentage was. It can't have been more than 3 or 4% were women, I don't think. It didn't feel like that. There were just a very few around. And they all did everything. And I remember it made life very much more pleasant. I'm just remembering being on duty as a couple with various people going around in air raid shelters on night duty and on various jobs. Yeah.
You said also they did everything. Is that right? You know, did they do the same tasks as men?
As far as I remember, yes, definitely. I mean, the ordinary tasks that we were all allocated to do from time to time, the cooking and the cleaning and all this kind of thing that you had to go on everywhere, there were more by nature of their skills at those days doing administrative work, secretarial work, but a lot of people were out driving or nursing and so forth. I'm just trying to think of individual cases. It's only because it was at that period when they began to get women there, was time of air raids, and that's where I remember them, in air raid shelters. Like the one I spoke of, that I had in the film with Muriel Davis was her name, who was there as the permanent group in Bread Street model shelter in 1940-41 for several months. That kind of thing. But then, as I said, going out to North Africa. It was, I don't know when exactly, I think the middle of 1942, that eventually we got the go-ahead to go. We must have had extra training of driving larger vehicles, hospital training. Most of us were back on working in hospitals in London. I suppose the group of about 30, 35 people that went out at that time were drawn from different parts of the unit. We finished up the last period of time, whether it was a matter of days or weeks, in the Middlesex Hospital, I believe, which two or three wards there were places that people lived. And we were issued uniform. Now, the business of having uniform was very interesting, because it took away the occasional, very occasional, caustic remark whilst travelling and that kind of thing, and not being in uniform. So I remember feeling when got fully kitted up, or whatever it's called, feeling a certain satisfaction that I'd become anonymous again, sort of sticking out like a sore thumb, looking healthy and hopping on and off buses in ordinary civilian clothes. And that, I wonder whether many of us, or if I've ever, until now, sort of talked about this feeling of you were in a uniform. The fact that it was a khaki uniform, looking military, with Red Cross and epaulettes and FAU on it, and brown shoes. It was a strange mixture. So there we were. And one morning we went to, by train, I think, to Liverpool. It might have been Glasgow. I really don't know. It was some... That's an awful thing for Liverpudlians or Glaswegians to hear, but I don't know where it was, where we were. We embarked on a troop ship that was some big P&O one-time cruise liner, I forget which one it was, and joined somewhere out North Atlantic, or possibly we went all together from different ports. What I believe was the largest convoy of the war. There were 40-something ships. For some reason, 42 is in my mind, but maybe that's the year. I think it was 40 ships. And for weeks and weeks, we zigzagged way out in the Atlantic and down round Cape of Good Hope and to Durban. Weeks and weeks. Can't remember how many.
Were you with the troops?
Yes, we were. Yes, indeed, we were part of a group of so many hundreds of troops on this ship, and we were all together in one great room area that was stiflingly hot. And so, when the weather got hot, it was marvellous to be able to get out on deck. So you slept, bathed in sweat, and every morning you looked, and there were the same ships in the same position. I don't know how they managed it. Zigzagging all the time, it's a most amazing business of so many miles and then all changing direction without lights and nobody blown up on that trip. There were lectures on board. We had our own sort of group lectures. We just passed the time, but it was a lengthy trip. We stopped west coast of Africa, Freetown, and we were anchored there for a few days, and that was really swelteringly hot. We had a gramophone with us, a portable wind-up gramophone, and some records, and got permission to play some of these records. I seem to remember starting a kind of half-hour a day little classical concert of records on the ship's loudspeakers with us.
How did you get on with the soldiers?
Fine.
Did they understand you were pacifists and what you were doing? They did it properly.
I think so, and this is an old cliche, the nearer the war, the more tolerance, the further away, the less. I can't remember any arguments, fights. There must have been a lot of caustic remarks and dislike, but I don't recall them. I don't know whether my memory wipes them out, but I don't recall them. Because we must have done things with them. There were various exercises on board, you know, exercises in case of attack from the air or submarine and all the rest of it. And we joined in with these. We all went to our first aid posts. I remember a few moments of being fairly scared when there was a lot of gunfire and then somebody came in bleeding profusely, and I just assumed we were under attack, but he'd fallen down a gangway or something and badly injured himself, and the gunfire was some blanks being shot off. But it all happened at once. Great confusion, noise and blood, and then just somebody to be bandaged up, and that was all it was. No, the convoy was very lucky to have got through unscathed. Then this particular trip so happened, we were in Durban for weeks and weeks, I think about six, and in a transit camp waiting for word every day of continuing on and not knowing. And then so we were, it was organised in various ways. A lot of local Quakers there spent turns in looking after us, and it fell to my lot to be kind of, secretary of invitations, so that I collected the names of all the people that wanted to have people out for the evening. And after a bit, we'll go around begging people to go, because they say, "Oh, I've been out to so-and-so's three times already. Can't you get somebody else?" We were over looked after, which was marvellous. And they were very, very hospitable in Durban. And a lot of us got work in a hospital. I forget what it was called, the King Edward the VII or something, or VIII would it be, Native and Asian Hospital. And I worked there for a bit, for about 1 or 2 weeks we were there, just doing ordinary hospital work. And one day, because I gave out pills in one ward of Africans, I remember, 20 or 30 of them, which is not very funny thinking back, but, and I got one out of step, they were numbered, and I gave out number one's pills and number two's pills, and I was one wrong all the way around the ward, but nobody seemed to suffer in any way. So I both had an awful shock that somebody was going to be suffering from the wrong treatment, but realisation, possibly a bad realisation, it didn't necessarily matter just once. And, yes, we visited some African college. Fort Hare, I think. No, I can't remember. Anyway, that was a very pleasant interlude, and lots of, compared with England, marvellous food. I remember 7-pound tins of jam, which you could put as much jam on your biscuits and butter as you wanted, and things that from rationed England were incredible. I believe I put on a great deal of weight there. Then the whole group of us got on a single ship, not in convoy, a fast ship that went at top speed to bottom of, I mean, the south end of the Suez Canal. Is that port side? I think it is. And that's where we landed, and we're in a camp. First impressions of being in Egypt, where the moon was bright enough, a full moon at night, to be able to read even the words of these little airgram things that were photographed in England, and then they came out as photocopies, about postcard size, from a full letter. And I was even able to read in the full moon news from England on that, which was the first letters we'd had for weeks and weeks. That became the beginning of the great importance of letters to and fro, which often were delayed or lost, you know, but often delayed for months and months. And then I don't remember how we got to Cairo. And camped in some barracks near the pyramids. These are all just vague memories. And then we went to Alexandria. And almost at once, I didn't start any training, ready for going what was going to be a long trip up into North African desert. It was just before El Alamein, Battle of El Alamein, and the long, long, long advance through North Africa with Montgomery's. But we didn't know this. This is about 2 months before. I suddenly had an enormous fever, which turned out to be sandfly fever, which put me in hospital, naturally. And I found out what a military hospital was like as a patient. And because of the fact the German army were almost at the gates of Cairo, this hospital was evacuated completely with all its patients, and because I was sick there too, onto a hospital ship to Haifa in Palestine.